In 2017, Australian actor Hugh Jackman opened on more than 3,000 screens with his take on the legendary 19th century Connecticut-born impresario P.T. Barnum, subject of Jackman's film The Greatest Showman.
Ladies and gents, this is the moment you've waited for.
By the end of the oh-so-critical first weekend, however, it looked like this was anything but the moment we'd waited for. Ticket sales for the $84 million production were a paltry $8.8 million. The Boston Globe called it 105 minutes in hell. But then, in a turnaround that would have amazed and thrilled P.T. Barnum himself, something happened. The People checked in with their reviews. Second week ticket sales nearly doubled to $15 million. So far, the film has grossed $434 million worldwide, making it one of the most unexpected box office smashes in recent memory. Barnum, it appeared, was back. I'm Walt Woodward, Connecticut State historian, and this is Barnum Circus, Barnum's Connecticut. If you ask Connecticut residents who's P.T. Barnum, you're likely to get one answer.
Well, he was the man that started the circus phenomenon back in, I believe, the 1800s, early 1900s.
P.T. Barnum was the guy that I believe started the circus. That's how I know him.
To tell the story of P.T. Barnum, we need to go back before his time. We need to go to Wisconsin. Baraboo, Wisconsin, where I traveled to attend the 69th Annual Circus Historical Society Convention. Baraboo is a place where in 1884, five brothers, Charles, Albert, Otto, Alfred, and John Ringling, formed the Ringling Brothers Circus, and it was the winter headquarters of that circus and several others until 1917. After that, it remained the home of many of the Ringling family and many former circus performers. As a result, Baraboo today is still a circus town, the home to Circus World Museum, the International Clown Hall of Fame, and a renowned circus history library and research center. The convention was held at the 1905 Edwardian Mansion home of Al Ringling, oldest of the Ringling brothers, recently restored by a former Ringling Circus trainmaster and his wife, a famous circus motorcycle performer. There I found an impressive international gathering of circus scholars, performers, and circus art collectors, as well as many P.T. Barnum fans, one of whom was Professor Vanessa Tolman, Director of City and Culture at Sheffield University in the United Kingdom.
I think Barnum was one of the greatest producers in the history of entertainment, of business, of management. I'm probably one of the greatest fans of P.T. Barnum.
But, Tolman said, he did not invent the circus. So who did?
Philip Astley and his wife Patty in London in 1768. With the combination of three different traditions, the equestrian riding tradition, the clowning tradition from pantomime and the stage, and the street arts, you know, juggling, what type, wire walking. He put all those into a ring, and that is what I see as the birth of modern circus.
So Barnum didn't invent the circus. An English couple did, and 42 years before Barnum was even born. I asked Tolman if she'd be surprised to learn that so many of the people I'd talked to in Connecticut thought he had.
Well, funny you might say that. That's exactly what they said to me at immigrations when I came through. They said to me, what are you here in America for? And I said, I'm here to be at the Circus Historical Society meeting in Wisconsin, and I'm a circus historian. And they said, really? You have circus in England? And I said, we invented it. And he said, I thought P.T. Barnum invented circus.
Well, there must be something to this idea. Maybe Barnum was the inventor of the American circus. So I sat down in the library of the Al Ringling Mansion with Janet M. Davis, professor of American Studies at the University of Texas and author of The Circus Age, Culture and Society Under the American Big Top.
The history of the circus in America is really a fascinating microcosm of the history of this nation. Prior to the Constitutional Convention of 1787, we have, you know, these sort of singular animals coming to America, plus people who could perform juggling or, you know, various elements of circus, but what happens in 1793 is that it all comes together. An Englishman by the name of John Bill Ricketts arrives in Philadelphia in 1792 with the intent to open a riding school and to train horses to perform tricks.
Ricketts and his riding school were a smashing success.
When you read the advertisements in these early American newspapers, they say, Mr. Ricketts will be performing at full speed. And because this is a horse-powered world in this era, the horse, you know, being shown to do such miraculously amazing things, you know, with people dancing on them, horses jumping, and horses being trained to do all sorts of amazing feats, in the early years of the circus, it really was very equine-centered as an institution.
So how do we get from John Bill Ricketts in 1793 to The Greatest Showman?
What happens over time is the circus just begins to grow and grow. So as the National Road takes shape in the 1810s, the circuses, they travel it. In 1825, this is a really important moment in circus history because a very innovative showman named Joshua Purdy Brown from Somers, New York, develops a really important innovation because he was going to show at Wilmington, Delaware. Okay, and this is late 1825, but the town leaders of Wilmington said, you can't perform here. We do not allow such amusement in our city. And this is in the midst of the Second Great Awakening. So this is a religious revivalism period, and there's a lot of social reform movements going on, and there was a real strong call of, you know, being against any kind of amusement where people are displaying and performing their bodies for pay. So what does Brown do? He instead performs just outside the city limits, and he erects a tent made of sailcloth.
The big top.
So this is a pavilion circus. He doesn't even call it a tent at this point, but that's what we know it as. It was very successful. It establishes the circus as an institution that could travel, very, very mobile, and could perform at a stop a time in one day. So you could, you know, the daily ritual from show stop to show stop. Within a few short years, the tenting circus becomes the norm in America, which makes it a uniquely American institution. These tenting circuses are performing on the frontier margins of American society, and they are so popular because people are starved for entertainment.
At this point, there's a lot of opposition to Brown's circus. People felt that it wasn't very respectable. So he had an idea. What if he displayed some sort of zoological compendium of marvels that would be seen as both entertaining and educational?
One of his sub-companies in 1828 in Charleston, South Carolina, actually develops a separate menagerie and the Big Top Circus, and you would pay separate admission for each. And so what it did was that it was a kind of moral geography that it was setting up for those people who were uncomfortable with the circus, they could go see those animals and they could see this kind of wonders of the world, something for everyone.
So, it's not the circus itself and it's not the Big Top, nor is it the exotic animals. So, what did Barnum do to make the circus the greatest show on earth?
Barnum brings a couple of really towering innovations to the circus when he enters the business in 1871. He brings size and scale. He operates a huge wagon show, but he's also working with really seasoned partners. So William Cameron Coop is one of his partners. And Coop and Barnum do some pretty amazing things.
In 1872, they take the show on the railroad. Coop develops a way to roll the wagons off of rail cars.
But the earliest shows that tried to travel by railroad in the antebellum era and before the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, they were known as kind of bad shows because they had to haul equipment from the railroad yard. There was, you know, gauge and track differences in different parts of the country. So what's happening in 1872 is the standardization process of track and gauge is underway. way.
Right.
And by the 80s, it's really, you know, fairly complete. And so Coop, in developing his logistical innovations to the circus, and then Barnum, with his extraordinary intelligence regarding the kind of cultural pulse of the nation, they come together and create an amazing show. And it just grows from there. And the railroad allows that show to expand in size and scale. In 1881, they now have three rings. And the show has become so big. And over the course of the next decade, those big tops can hold over 10,000 people.
Barnum, it seems, was the greatest showman because he, with the help of some very significant partners, actually did make the greatest show truly great through dramatically expanded size and scale, brilliant performances, brilliant marketing, and brilliant innovations, too.
He understood how the newspapers worked. He understood where they were going.
That's Joe Dobrow, marketing expert and author of Pioneers of Promotion, How Press Agents for Buffalo Bill, P.T. Barnum, and the World's Columbian Exposition Created Modern Marketing.
He had a background in retail sales and in salesmanship. He had a background in patent medicine advertising, which was perhaps the most widespread but also controversial form of marketing of the 19th century. And so all of those things fed into the calculus of Barnum as he shifted his career into showmanship and ultimately into the circus. To put it in perspective, by the middle of the 19th century already, all of these marketing techniques were being referred to popularly in the press as Barnumisms. I think he felt that his role here was to reach out and educate to both the Brahmins and the Bowery. He understood both crowds, and he understood that he had a role to play as an educator and a moralizer.
Promoting Barnum's railroad circuses involved a marketing effort that began weeks before the circus itself came to town, with the arrival of Barnum's advance marketing team.
They would be traveling into a town like Baraboo and meeting with the editors and beginning to talk it up. And the bill posting crews would be following in their wake. Now, in the case of Barnum or the Barnum and Bailey Circus, that in itself was an attraction because often their advertising car might have a steam-powered calliope as part of it. And so if you can imagine, you are an 8-year-old kid in Baraboo, Wisconsin, in the 19th century, and Barnum and Bailey's advertising car has just showed up in town, and there's this calliope music playing there, and there are these vivid pictures of wild and exotic animals drawn on the side.
So the mere arrival of the advancement is the start of the promotion.
And they knew it, of course, because they had seen the emotional pull that the beautiful posters that they created had on people, and what was the advertising railroad car but a moving billboard.
And then, weeks after the town was plastered over and word spread to the hinterlands, the circus came. Nothing could rival Circus Day for pure, unadulterated excitement.
Oh, Circus Day, boom, 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 just comes around once a year. Oh, boom, 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 boom.
Entire towns would shut down. Businesses would shut down. Circus Day was a phenomenon in small-town America.
It was the behavior of the crowds, the thousands who streamed to these showgrounds, that doubled a town's size temporarily for Circus Day. People engaged in fighting. They did all sorts of things. There were thefts on Circus Day. It could be a day of real danger.
So Circus Day is kind of like Carnival in Europe. It is the day of transgression, right? The normal rules don't apply on this day.
Absolutely. And the funny thing, too, is that Circus Day was also a day to go shopping. So Main Streets would often offer Circus Day bargains. So it's this day of consumerism, and people would save their pennies, save their money so they could spend on Circus Day.
And then there was the three-ring circus itself, the Barnum Circus innovation that transformed the whole experience of entertainment.
It literally made the show so active and so dynamic that it was impossible to take it all in at once.
I think that that too big to see at once sort of ethos of that show was absolutely part of its success. Now, it became a defining feature of Americanization, too, because if it's too big to see at once, well, you might need to see it more than once, so that's part of it. And also, the kind of grand spectacle of constant activity, three rings, outer hippodrome track, two stages, plus a parade before the show, and the unloading on the showgrounds was also a form of spectacle that attracted people to the showgrounds, oftentimes in the dead of night at the railroad yard as people waited for the arrival of the first train coming in from the previous show stop. So the whole process became a logistical spectacle, both in terms of novelty from people from around the world, animals from around the world, and the kind of physical setup and disassembly.
And then, as quickly as it arrives, the greatest show people have ever seen is gone again. And that's another Barnum & Bailey innovation, incredible logistics.
The military, the U.S. Army, actually follows these railroad shows because they want to learn the methods of efficient tearing down and erection of these showgrounds and transporting supplies and people and animals becomes a real trademark of the circus. And the kind of irony, I think, as we stand many years after the fact, is that it's just like a three-ring circus becomes this kind of, you know, synonym for chaos, or metaphor, I should say, for chaos in the American lexicon, but nothing could really be further from the truth in terms of the actual circus.
So now I think I get it. A big, spectacular, too big to take it all in experience, appealing to all classes, brilliantly marketed and organized to move across the nation with speed and efficiency. That's what made the greatest show on earth and what made P.T. Barnum the greatest showman. Coming up, we'll travel back to Connecticut to learn about the many roles P.T. Barnum played here in the state he loved. I'm Walt Woodward. This is Barnum Circus, Barnum's Connecticut. I'm Walt Woodward, Connecticut State Historian, and you're listening to Barnum Circus, Barnum's Connecticut, a Connecticut public radio special about the man who was arguably Connecticut's most important native son, P.T. Barnum. We learned about Barnum's role in creating the greatest show on earth. Now we're going back to Barnum's childhood and his influence in Bridgeport, the city Barnum helped create and called home for much of his life. Kathy Marr is the executive director of the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport. She explained to me that Barnum's roots in Connecticut ran very deep indeed.
The Barnum family goes back to the 17th century in Connecticut, and his family settled in Bethel, very rural community. He was one of 12 children, and Barnum says very young, he did not like the agrarian lifestyle. It just was not for him. When he was 12, he had the opportunity to go on a cattle herd down to Lower Manhattan, and he, at 12 years old, he was fascinated and captured by the metropolis. That was his path. Somehow, some way, that was going to be his destination. So he was just like every Fairfield County person today. He's a New York commuter.
Barnum married Charity Hallett at 19 in 1829, and after a brief sojourn in the city, the couple returned to Connecticut, where Barnum found his first financial success as a lottery agent.
He found a niche. He was actually becoming very wealthy being a lottery agent. Connecticut reversed its legislation, and that income disappeared. And he said, the only place that I can really make this kind of money is I've got to take my family to New York.
After trying his hand at various careers in Connecticut and New York, which included running a boarding house and then a pub, being a peddler and then a trader, editing a newspaper, and clerking in a general store, Barnum at age 25 came into his own when he took the plunge into the entertainment business. On that day, in July 1835,
Barnum, according to one historian, gave birth to modern American popular culture. And he did it with an attraction that Barnum believed could not fail, one that leaves us today just scratching our heads in wonder. The attraction was a woman named Joyce Heth.
Now, the story was that she was the 161-year-old nurse to George Washington.
And she was an African-American woman.
And she was an African-American woman. She came with papers of slavery, yes. Now, Barnum purchases her interest, and he sets up a tour where she would sing hymns and tell stories about little George on her knee. It just went on and on. And he would spend hours inking playbills that would go ahead of the upcoming tour where she was going to be presented. People were automatically intrigued. This was the key about this. It didn't matter if it was real or not. What he was delivering was curiosity. And you, in a new democratic America, had a choice of believing it or not.
Under Barnum's management, Joyce Heth proved an astonishing success. Opening in New York, she drew huge crowds and press interests there and throughout Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts. At each performance, curious onlookers were shown, as evidence of her authenticity, a bill of sale from Augustine Washington, George's father, to her later owner. Barnum's exploitation of Heth and its characterizations and treatment of other African-American performers has earned him a reputation among some historians as a purveyor of racism. Benjamin Reese, author of The Showman and the Slave, writes, "He had these new ways of making racism seem fun and for people to engage in activities that degraded racially subjective persons in ways that were intimate and funny and surprising and novel." And medical ethicist Harriet A. Washington wrote that while the abuse of black performers in Barnum shows was commonplace, it was also immoral. Barnum's defenders counter by arguing that Barnum lived in a deeply racist age and that his acts were a mirror of prevailing cultural attitudes. Heth and a series of subsequent hoaxes, such as the half-monkey, half-fish Fiji mermaid, made Barnum's reputation and put him on the fast track to wealth. One wonders what the draw of these humbugs, the 19th century term Barnum used for them, was for the thousands and thousands of people who paid to view them. Joe Dobrow, marketing expert, explains.
The notion of humbug has, I think, transformed in its meaning from that century to this one. But in the 19th century, it was a fairly common term, and it essentially meant an elaborate hoax. It wasn't a stunt. It wasn't, I would say, an intentional deception so much as a challenge. This was Barnum trying to push people to say, I'm entertaining you, but I'm doing this in a clever way. Can you figure it out?
Buoyed by his successes, Barnum set up the institution that was to provide the foundation for his innovation, his international fame, and the fortune that saw him become only the second millionaire in American history. Here's Kathy Marr from the Barnum Museum again.
His major success was the American Museum in Lower Broadway in New York City, which ran full operation for almost 30 years and actually entertained millions of people in its lifetime. It was everything from America's first aquarium, its first zoo. People could come and spend an entire day exploring wonders that you just had no idea existed in a world that really had a limited accessibility to anything. He knew somehow what people wanted before they even knew what they wanted.
Barnum hired families from countries like Germany, China, and Japan and brought them to the American Museum.
So he's introducing the world to Americans for the first time. Barnum believed the world was for everybody, and it was okay for the highbrow to enjoy going to the Morrill Lecture Theater to see a show. But what's very important about what Barnum did with the Morrill Lecture Room, of course, it was completely temperance. There was a teetotaler pledge outside those doors. He was making sure that the scripts were appropriate to the more genteel audiences.
Even as Barnum was finding fame and fortune in the city, he turned his entrepreneurial eye back to Connecticut, and especially to the little soundside town of Bridgeport.
Everything Barnum did was strategic, and the reason Bridgeport was so appealing to him is it was already a natural industrial hub opportunity. The trains were already thriving. It's right on the Long Island Sound. The ferry company was already driving. And, of course, the Boston Post Road. All of these forms of transportation we are still using today. That was Barnum's route. So he saw those opportunities already in place, and it was beautiful. The Long Island Sound, the seashore, was not developed the way we see it today. So it offered a sense of beauty. So it gave him joy. And then New York is where he worked.
Barnum's first major investment in Bridgeport was an exotically beautiful showplace residence.
So Oranistan was Barnum's first major Bridgeport country estate. Modeled after the Brighton Pavilion in England, Barnum had been to England and he saw this exotic palace and he wanted his own. And he was certainly making enough money that he was able to build this extraordinary mansion with huge onion domes, beautiful gardens and conservatories. It was nothing that people in this country would have seen, unless you were very well traveled.
Perhaps Barnum gave Bridgeport its first great exotic mansion because Bridgeport had given him the means to build that mansion through a diminutive young boy named Charles Stratton, who the world came to know as Tom Thumb.
I think it's one of the most endearing love stories, believe it or not. Barnum's brother, living in Bridgeport, knew about the Stratton family here in town, and he just said, they have a son, he's just stopped growing, but he's just the most charming, adorable little entertainer you'd ever see. He might work for the American Museum. Now, Charles was only 4 or 5 years old, and Barnum was just totally charmed by him. And he worked out, he negotiated a contract with the Stratton family to hire him, pay a salary, room, board, and also provided service for his parents being caretakers of their son. He needed to have a grand name, so it became General Tom Thumb, the mythological Tom Thumb, but give him rank.
Barnum's tour with Tom Thumb made him America's first international entertainment impresario. And as his fame and fortune grew, so did his commitment to Bridgeport and Connecticut. Always a visionary, he next undertook creating a model industrial community a half mile from the center of Bridgeport. With local lawyer William Noble, he purchased 225 acres on the east bank of the Pequannock River and began recruiting industrialists to bring their factories to a city intended to work for both them and their employees.
It was a complete utopian vision on Barnum's part. He wanted to make sure every skilled working force member of the community had a place to call their own, that it didn't become tenement housing, that the land was parceled out for housing developments.
So this is a planned community.
This is a planned
community. In the mid-19th century.
In the mid-19th century, absolutely. And what was integrated into the housing were churches, were parks, ultimately a hospital. Every amenity that people needed to have healthy lives, lives with well-being, that's what he was really designing. And it worked. It actually worked for quite a long time.
For all his successes, Barnum's career was marked by setbacks, too. Some were self-inflicted, like an ill-considered investment in a clock company that he intended to relocate to East Bridgeport. That one bankrupted him, but only temporarily. Other setbacks, like a series of fires, did more damage. One fire was apparently set by Southern sympathizers in the Civil War, destroying his American museum. Another burned his exotic home, Oranistan, to cinders. But Barnum bounced back, moving from the museum into the circus business and from Oranistan to a second Barnum home called Lindencroft. With his wife Charity suffering from chronic illness, he later moved into a new mammoth home that combined, in Barnum's words, the greatest convenience with the maximum comfort, Waldemere.
They moved closer to the Long Island Sound, had that view, had that breeze, and they built Waldemere. And then two other houses were built on the site of their land for two of his daughters.
Barnum made his presence felt everywhere in Bridgeport, in central city office buildings, public parks, and an array of civic projects. Now one of, if not the, most important person in a growing industrial city, Barnum in 1865 was nominated, ran for, and won a Republican seat in the Connecticut General Assembly. And although he was a freshman legislator with no prior political experience, Barnum made his presence felt right from the start.
The thing I love about his story is that he just doesn't wait until the day the legislative session opens. He comes up the night before and he begins politicking immediately.
Sally Whipple, executive director of the Old State House in Hartford, says Representative Barnum had quite the impact.
He's coming into the legislature as a junior representative, but he knows the world and he knows the people and he knows what he thinks and he knows what he wants to have happen. So he seems to immediately assess the situation, who's on this side of this issue and that side of that issue, makes his approach that night, and he affects leadership of the House. He was a party man, but he wasn't partisan. And he wasn't a wire puller, which was their way of saying somebody pulling the puppet strings.
Barnum was a man of many political opinions, and he was also a man with a cause.
He was extremely passionate about freedom for African Americans following the Civil War. And so one of the things that he said in his autobiography was that he wanted to run for office in order to vote for the 13th Amendment, which would abolish slavery throughout the United States.
Barnum came into office a month after Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated. So securing Connecticut's ratification of the U.S. Constitution's 13th Amendment was a relatively easy undertaking. But that wasn't enough for Barnum. He then called on his fellow legislators to approve a public referendum to change the Connecticut Constitution to allow African Americans to vote. In an impassioned and eloquent speech to the assembly, Barnum noted that the provision in the 1818 state constitution explicitly limiting the vote only to white men had been a concession to southern plantation owners who did business in the state and that it needed to be changed. No other New England state, he said, has ever so disgraced herself. Sally Whipple.
When he talked about that, it really gave me a sense of the breadth of history, the length of history. Here, the Constitutional Convention of 1818 was held in the Old State House. And then years later, here is P.T. Barnum, of all people, coming back and saying, look at what you guys did in 1818. It was wrong, and we need to address that and change it and make it right. And it happens in the very same building. They take the vote in the very same building.
One of the persons whose attitudes may most have changed over time is P.T. Barnum himself. Though he adamantly called himself a lifelong champion for equal rights for all, it's hard for many people to reconcile the man who exhibited the aged slave Joyce Heth with the outspoken civil rights advocate Barnum unquestionably was in 1865.
There were several people working alongside him, including the governor, trying to get white taken out of that clause. It passed the House, it passed the legislature, and then went out for a referendum on October 2nd of 1866. And the people of Connecticut voted it down by 5,000 votes. So the word white was not stricken from our Constitution in Connecticut until 1876.
In addition to promoting civil rights legislation, Barnum did not hesitate to take on the state's most powerful private interest, the railroads.
Well, the railroads, he felt, were having an unfair advantage in the legislature because they had lobbyists who were really controlling some of the people in the legislature and having things go their own way. And a lot of historians agree with his view on that. So what he did was he worked to affect who was in charge of committees. He had the railroad committee chair replaced. He had the commissioner of the railroad replaced so that he lessened their power in the legislature.
One of Barnum's most memorable moments as a legislator came during one of his anti-railroad speeches.
He is delivering an impassioned speech, as he seems to have done quite frequently, on the House floor. And in the middle of his speech, he's handed a telegram, he looks at it, and he puts it down and resumes his speech. Afterwards, he tells one of his fellow representatives from Winsted that he had just gotten the message that his museum in Manhattan was on fire and that total destruction was certain. Barnum had been given this telegram in the middle of his speech about the railroads, and without the slightest evidence of agitation, he laid the telegram upon his desk and finished his speech. And everybody who observed this, he said, noted that he had no change in facial expression, that he gave no hint that something bad was happening at that moment, even though he knew he was losing that entire museum that he had built in a gigantic fire.
Overall, Barnum served 4 terms as a state legislator, during which he advanced some very forward-looking legislation, like advocating to end capital punishment, putting a railroad bridge across the Connecticut River, and ending Connecticut's time-honored practice of having 2 state capitals. I'm Walt Woodward. You're listening to Barnum Circus, Barnum's Connecticut. After the break, we'll hear more about Barnum's impact on Connecticut. I'm state historian Walt Woodward. This is Barnum Circus, Barnum's Connecticut. P.T. Barnum was a Republican state legislator in Connecticut from 1866 to 1869. If Barnum's moralism won him kudos in the state legislature, it received an altogether different welcome when Barnum served as mayor of Bridgeport in 1875. In that post, he sought to impose some of the righteous living standards he'd instituted in his model community of East Bridgeport on its neighbor across the river. Here's Kathy Marr again, executive director of the Barnum Museum in Bridgeport.
Being the mayor gave him the opportunity to ensure utilities. He wanted to clean up the streets. He wanted to get control of crime. So he had a very specific platform.
That platform included very strict enforcement of liquor laws, shutting down the city's gambling hells and brothels, reducing the size of city government, and providing forced employment for the city's class of loungers and loafers. Barnum quickly found himself at all-out war with Bridgeport's Democratic Council, aldermen, and their allies in the press. After only 9 months, Barnum announced he would leave office at the end of his 1-year term, saying, "No one can congratulate me on the event more heartily than I do myself."
So it was a quick in and quick out. He didn't run for re-election.
Barnum left the mayor's office, but his commitment to Bridgeport continued. His focus now was the circus business he'd entered into as a retirement project at age 60, and which he and partners James L. Hutchinson and James A. Bailey were building into the greatest show on earth. In 1880, the 3 men bought and enclosed a 10-acre lot in Bridgeport adjacent to the New York, New Haven, and Hartford Railroad tracks and turned it into the winter quarters for their mammoth enterprise. They built a 100-foot square elephant house, separate buildings for the wildcats, other caged animals, amphibious animals, and the monkeys, stables for 700 horses, a nursery for newborn animals, and a veterinary facility, harness, paint, and blacksmith shops. A 300-foot-long building covered 8 tracks of circus rail cars, and a circus ring was built so acrobats and riders could stay in practice. That was just the beginning.
Circling this huge plot of land is the housing, because it takes hundreds of people. When you think about a circus traveling, a show, a greatest show on earth traveling, it's a community traveling. And during the winter months, things had to get repaired, get everybody rested for the next season. They came to Bridgeport.
Though the winter quarters were closed to the public for safety reasons, one of the advantages of having the facility in Bridgeport is that it could be used to stage media events. Joe Dobrow describes how Toadie Hamilton, Barnum's chief public relations promoter, used the winter quarters to get coverage from the New York press.
He would invite newspaper reporters up from New York or wherever, and he would always find some way to generate a story that would make it into the news, onto the front page of the newspaper, in anticipation of the opening of the Barnum and Bailey show, which was often at Madison Square Garden. Sometimes that meant experiments. And we can cringe at them a little bit today, but again, let's put it in its historical context. So, for example, there was an experiment in which Toadie set out pans of beer and whiskey in the polar bear's cage to see what it would do. And there was even 1 year in which Toadie set up the dinner for the visiting press corps inside the wild animal cage with the wild animals in there. And so the trade paper, the Fourth Estate, was commenting about this, and it said, "Not everybody decided to partake in dinner that night, but some did, and they enjoyed the meal very much." these were not real news events. They didn't belong on the front page of the newspaper, but they were so clever and they were so interesting and they were so different that they found their way there.
One of the animals who wintered over in Bridgeport, at least for the short time he was alive here, was an elephant so popular and well-known that his name actually entered our dictionary as a term for something of very, very large size. Janet Davis, lead historian on the American Experience documentary The Circus, tells us about Jumbo.
So Jumbo is an Abyssinian elephant, and he's from Africa. He's lives in London at the London Zoo, and then Barnum buys him. But he comes over in the early 1880s, and his arrival in New York is another cultural sensation. And this, of course, is well-primed because Barnum, again, being such a master at publicity, has already prepared the public for the arrival of Jumbo. And so when he arrives, it is a kind of spectacle in its own right, with people lining the streets, Jumbo mania taking hold. And he is a sensation throughout his career, his short career. It's really a sad end because in Canada, again, he's being walked to the train and he's being walked on the railroad tracks and he is killed by a train.
Barnum Circus has always featured great numbers of exotic animals as well as herds of workhorses. As a result, Barnum was subject to close scrutiny from those whose major concern was protecting animals' welfare. None of these was more observant of Barnum than Henry Berg, the founder of the American Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the ASPCA. Janet Davis.
In 1880, in April, Barnum is performing at Madison Square Garden, opening the show, you know, the season. And he had a horse named Salamander, who was a fire horse, who would jump through a fiery hoop. And so Henry Berg, who was the president of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, which was the nation's first organized, incorporated animal protection society, founded in 1866. Berg really was uncomfortable with this fire horse act. He was worried about pain. He thought any kind of movement through a fiery hoop, that's gotta hurt. And so he planned to bring his team of officers who have the power of arrest.
So he's going to raid the circus
right, with
these enforcers.
Yeah. So they're going to, you know, come and they're going to do their job. But so Barnum knew all of this. He saw an opportunity for publicity. So what he did is he decided, okay, with Berg and his team here, I am going to show him that I can jump through a fire hoop and it doesn't hurt one bit. So Barnum jumps through the hoop as Berg and his men are standing there, and a whole bunch of his clowns also jump through the hoop. And Berg just said, basically, okay, Barnum, you got me. That's that. Barnum becomes the vice president of the Bridgeport SPCA. He and Berg became friends. He left money to the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals in his will. And he also funded the erection of a statue of Berg in Bridgeport.
A man of immense energy and creative drive, he remained enthusiastically entrepreneurial right up to his final days. In October 1890, the 80-year-old Barnum wrote, "I eat, sleep, and walk like a boy of 16. Among the projects he pursued that year were real estate investments in Colorado, building a huge luxury summer hotel along the Long Island Sound, and the construction in East Bridgeport of a new sailing schooner to be named the P.T. Barnum. Mindful of the passing years, though, Barnum had also begun to think about his legacy, and he spent much time laying out the details of what would be his legacy gift to Bridgeport.
The Barnum Museum on Main Street here in downtown is really the last surviving building fully attributed to Barnum. There's certainly nothing like it anywhere else in Connecticut. It is Romanesque, exotic influence, Richardsonian in a lot of ways, but it's a massive timber dome that sits on three major floors The exterior is banded by decorative friezes that actually tell the story of the city's history up until its moment. You have the regional Indians depicted in these massive friezes, which are beautiful. You have the settlers. You have the Industrial Revolution. You have the Civil War. I mean, it takes you up to the moment in time where the building was built, so completed in 1893. And then other friezes below that have all kinds of animals. You can see monkeys and birds. People come today, they think it's a circus museum. It actually, in stone on the building, it is the Barnum Institute of Science and History. And that is his final gift to society.
Barnum intended his institute to house the Bridgeport Scientific Society and the Fairfield County Historical Societies and the Medical Associations, research and cultural organizations that didn't have a home.
So the third floor of the Barnum Museum is a place where Thomas Edison spoke. They debated the viability of electricity in this building. The Wright brothers spoke here. Curators from the American Museum of Natural History spoke here. It was a think tank. It was a place for community engagement and intellectual exchange.
By January of 1891, Barnum knew the end was drawing near. He told a friend then, "I have an old heart, and the doctors cannot cure an old heart." With friends and aides, he began to set his house in order. Playful to the last, though, he conspired with his public relations man, Toadie Hamilton, for one last surprise, Joe Dobrow.
On Barnum's deathbed, he brings Toadie Hamilton in, and it's hard to say whether it was one of their inventions or both of them, but they decide that Barnum would really like to see what the newspapers would write about him when he's dead. And so Toadie Hamilton brings in one of the New York newspapers, and they write his obituary, and they print his obituary, what turns out to be, I believe, about 3 weeks before he actually dies.
Barnum died on April 7th, 1891. And was buried in the place he had chosen years before in Bridgeport's Mountain Grove Cemetery, across from the grave of his friend Charles Stratton, Tom Thumb. In addition to the Barnum Museum, two monuments continue to attest to Barnum's enduring influence on the city he loved and the state he called home. One is the seated bronze statue of Barnum in Bridgeport's Seaside Park, looking out on Long Island Sound. Sculpted by Thomas Ball in 1888, it was placed in the park near his last home shortly after his death and remains a powerful testament to Barnum's life and its importance. The second monument is much smaller. In 1936, Bridgeport officials obtained congressional approval to mint 25,000 commemorative silver half dollars, honoring Bridgeport's first century as a city. They chose P.T. Barnum for the face of that coin. Two generations after he died, Barnum was not only singled out as Bridgeport's all-time most important citizen, he became the only Connecticutan ever to appear on a United States coin. It's hard to think of a better tribute to the man widely considered the father of modern mass entertainment. I'm Walt Woodward. Thanks for listening to Barnum Circus, Barnum's, Connecticut.